I want to begin by mentioning that if you see somebody who looks like me in the hallways, my brother is in the church this morning. He came to the first hour, and he's attending the worship service now. So if you see somebody who is a little younger, and he has skill, but I have age and treachery, so it all sorts of things. Now, we have been dealing in the past few weeks with lessons from different groups of people within the Bible. For those of you who haven't been here, a quick review of some of the places we've been. We've talked about lessons from kings and lessons from other kings, soldiers, children, poets.
What did y'all do last week?
Poets. We did poets for 2 weeks.
Oh, you did poets for 2 weeks. Oh, I got
first. It took 2 weeks to do poets.
Children. Lessons from children.
Lessons from children. Lessons from lepers. We talked about lepers for 1 week. Today we're going to talk about lessons from women.
Yes.
And in the first hour, that was created with a big reaction. One particular guy said, I guess we'll get out early, and there were then hisses and boos and stuff. It got a little ugly in the first hour. But in any event, we're going to look at lessons from women. And what I want to let you know is this probably is going to take more than 1 week. But there are going to be women that you might know by name. Deborah, you might have heard of. Naomi and Ruth, you might have heard of. You might have even heard of Abigail, although it's a little less likely you would have heard of her. It's not as likely that you would have heard of Huldah or a few of the others that we will eventually look at. But this is what we're going to do, is look at lessons from women, and it may take us a little while to get through this. We're going to start today in Judges chapter 4. So if you can find Judges chapter 4. As you're looking for that, let me remind you of how Scripture is structured in this portion of the Bible. In the first five books of the Bible, we study creation, and we learn of God's working with people. There is a turning towards the end of Genesis where God begins to work with a particular person and with his descendants. This is Abraham and Abraham's children. And by the time you come to the end of those first five books, that people group has grown quite large. That happened in Egypt. Egypt was threatened by this, so put them into slavery. They've been led out of slavery. In the book of Joshua, they have occupied the promised land, and God has moved people out to give them room there. And now in the book of Judges, they're settling in. And there's a pattern in the book of Judges. The term judge is used for a particular type of person. Sometimes, but not always, it might be a person as we would know a judge, a person who has a courtroom and who delivers verdicts of one kind or another on this or that situation. Hey, Kim, come on in. But it also has a different and more important meaning. The pattern was that people would just do what they wanted to do. And when you do what you want to do, very often that gets you in trouble. The people would get into trouble. They would cry to God for help. God would raise up a deliverer, someone who would rescue them from the circumstances they'd gotten into. That person was called a judge. Sometimes that person would actually be a judge. Sometimes the term deliverer or rescuer would be a better term for them. During that person's lifetime, things would get better. When that person died, everything would go back to the way it was. People get in trouble again, and the cycle would start again. And that cycle just runs through the book of Judges. So if you look at the first verse of chapter 4 of Judges, there was a deliverer by the name of Ehud, E-H-U-D in my translation. And my translation starts off and says, once he died, what happened? Everybody went right back to doing stuff that God had said was wrong. And once again, they got in trouble. The trouble they got into this time was that a king from Canaan came in, and an oppressing army came in. And the attention that's put in this chapter is less on the king than on his army commander. Can you pick up the name of the army commander in the middle of verse 2? Sisera or Sisera, we don't know particularly how to pronounce that. And it says in verse 3, the Israelites then cried to the Lord because the king had 900 iron chariots and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. Verse 4 tells you who the next deliverer is. Who's that? And that's a little unusual. Most of the time through the book of Judges, the deliverer, the rescuer, the judge was male. This one was female. What does it tell you? It tells you her function. I'm not going to say her occupation because I don't think that's a good term for that, but it tells you her function. And she had two functions. One was that she was a judge. That's at the end of my verse 4, I think it is. But she's got another function. What's that?
Prophetess.
That, again, is a little unusual. There's only a couple of people in the Old Testament who are female and identified that way. Huldah, which we will, a person we will talk about later, is the second one that has that distinction. It says in verse 5, where she used to stay. And in my translation, it's identified as under a tree. What kind of tree? Palm tree. And the tree was distinctive enough that it got a name. What was its name? Deborah's palm. Apparently, her knowledge of her was sufficient enough that her name was used on a local landmark. It says that she lived in a certain place in the highlands of one of the tribes, Ephraim is named, and the Israelites would come to her for justice. Now, very quickly, verse 6 says, on a particular day, she sent for someone by the name of Barak, and it tells you something about his heritage. This is Barak with one R, and so maybe that's a different person from one that might come to mind if you heard somebody talking about Barak or Barak. And what she says is, go pick up soldiers out of 2 of the 10 tribes, this one and another one. Take 10,000 of those soldiers, and I want you to go up against this army that's been oppressing Israel for the last 20 years. Go up against Sisera's army. And God's going to give you the victory. And I want you to look particularly at verse 8. What does Barak say in reply?
If you don't go up, I won't go.
If you go with us, then I'll go. If you don't go with us, I won't go. Now, who's he saying this to?
Deborah,
who is a judge and a prophetess. Her response is fascinating. Verse 9. What does she say? First, she says, I'll go with you. And then she adds, but there's a price. What's the price? You're not going to get the credit. God is going to put that army commander under the power of a woman. A woman's going to take him out. Now, who do you think the woman's going to be? That's what I would have thought, but it's not. This battle does take place. The soldiers run for their lives in the oppressing army. Sisera runs for his life. He finds this little family living someplace on the edge of the desert. They have a tent. He runs into the tent. He says to the woman in the tent, hide me, hide me. She says, sure, crawl under this carpet. We'll hide you under the carpet. And he goes and cowers under the carpet, and while he does, she takes a tent peg, and he's gone. This is a little bit brutal in here, right? Now, that's pretty much the story. The woman's name is Jael, J-A-E-L in my translation. That's verse 21. That's the little bloody part that's in here. Okay. And I want to bring your attention now to one more thing. Look at verse 1 of chapter 5. What do you see in verse 1? Chapter 5, verse 1. What do you see in chapter 5, verse 1? There has been a victory, and what happens? And there's a song about that victory. This probably was not unusual, but this one was recorded. Who sang that song? Deborah and Barak, or Barak. I stayed in the barracks when I was in the army, but I don't think this is spelled the same way as barracks, and I know it has the same meaning. Okay? The two of them sang the song of victory together. All right? Now, there's the facts. What lessons can we learn from Deborah? What lessons can we learn from Deborah? Welcome, sir.
Good morning.
If you're silent, we might all go home. What lessons did we learn?
She listened to God.
Anything jump to mind? I'm trying to set you guys up, right? We go through the whole of the book of Judges, and we got all these judges, one after another, after another, after another, and all of them are men, except this one. What do you learn? Yes, she's special, but there's another way of saying it. She's the counterexample. She's the counterexample that proves the falsity of the idea that God only uses men. Now, we worded it one way this morning in the first hour. And there was a criticism from a good friend of mine, Bob Cochran. He said, you didn't say that right. So let me tell you how he said it, and then I'm going to tell you his criticism. The way we said it was, God calls women just like he calls men. And Bob says, I'm not sure he calls them the same way as he calls men. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. I think he calls each person individual. I thought that was a good criticism. I thought that was a good correction. But let's try to figure out something. God calls, God uses women.
As well as.
As that was the phrase he took it that he said, I want you to say as well as, because that's sort of as well as. Yeah. Now, once you get that thought, where else can you expand it? He says to Timothy, don't let people despise your youth. Timothy seemed to be pretty young. Can God use a young person? You bet. Can God use an elderly person? You bet. Can he use an infirm person? He can use anyone he calls, as long as that person responds. God calls and uses women.
He's a donkey.
That was another interesting story, wasn't it? Guy's beating his donkey because his donkey won't go forward. Mm-hmm. And the donkey turns around and says, what are you beating me for? Are you blind? And then God lets him see the angel with the sword that's standing in front of him. The donkey's smart enough not to try to go forward. It's in there. Go look for it. I think this is also in Judges, but it's not the part we're looking at today. It's a good book to read through. Interesting things here. Right? God calls and God uses all kinds of people. And if you ever hear anybody say, God can't use this one, or God can't use that, be careful. That probably is a statement that somebody needs to think about more deeply. Probably is a statement that needs to be thought about more deeply. I like the correction. He doesn't call these folks maybe the same way as those. Those individual differences are going to be there. I can remember a long time ago when I was in graduate school, I was in a church that was the deacon group in our church was the power center of the church. This is different in our church. The deacons are a service ministry, and the process of trying to make church decisions, they have a connection with that. It's not that they're disconnected, but they don't have the control. This little church, the deacons had control. And they were self-perpetuating. The deacons would elect the next deacons. And somebody got subversive in that church and suggested that maybe there was another way of doing it. And as someone got through doing that, we ended up having elections for deacons for the first time. I was elected as a deacon and asked to serve. And so were two kids who were sophomores in college. I thought I was young. They were quite a bit younger. And I can remember the second or third deacons meeting that I attended. these two young men asked for the floor, and they said, the church has a house on its properties. We don't have that now, but we did with the missionary house. Now our property is across the street. But they had a two-story house with a big kitchen, a big meeting, and big rooms downstairs. Sitting back on the back corner, the church was in a downtown area. There was low-income housing across the street behind the church. The church had in its parking lot basketball nets. And these two young men said, there's kids from those housing areas across the street, from those communities across the street, who come over and play basketball on our courts. We want to live in the second floor of that house and get to know those kids. They were going to the University of Florida, which was 13 blocks down the road. They said, we want to just live there and get to know these kids and see what we can do. You know the reaction of the deacon group? Their reaction after a while of sort of thinking through the implications of absolutely not, they finally said, well, okay. Now, I'm sorry, but I'm going to be blunt. I'm going to tell you what they said. They said, okay, but we don't want those people. And there was a quotation mark around those people coming into our church and using the water fountains. I was appalled. The sense that God could use young people to get in the face of people who weren't hearing God very well was just clear in that moment. And what those kids did over the next 2 years was wonderful. They did some really good things in that church, connecting that some of the problems that are implicit in that reaction from some of the deacons, those sort of got moved out. And that was a little bit better church for a while because of that. Not all of them did. Some of them. But God can use young people. God can use older people. God can use men. And that's one of the lessons that's sitting here, I think, for you to see. Is there any other lesson you see? Let's save ourselves some time. Say yes. Let's go see if we can find it. What other lesson do you see here? And I'm not discounting these over here. But I think these are some that we can learn from lots of folks. What's special here, that lessons that we can learn here that maybe are not as easily learned in other places? Let me give you a hint. Go to chapter 5 and reread verse 1. I think that tells me something about Barak.
Yeah.
Barak is somebody who seems to have recognized God's presence and God's activity in Deborah's life to the point that he is saying something that I don't care who gets the credit. Some of you know that cliche, right? It's amazing what you can get done when you don't worry about who gets the credit. There's a little of that hiding in here. But what I see is, what can we accomplish when we work together compared to what can we accomplish when we work alone?
Well, the other thing is that song is more about Deborah and Barak even, that the leaders took the lead in Israel, that the people offered themselves willingly, bless the Lord.
Yeah, and I see something there about working together across what the world would put in as boundaries or barriers. Breaking through to where folks are cooperating that ordinarily the world would say, you know, well, this one works this way and that one works that way. But that idea of working together and staying together, they're accomplishing more together than they probably would have alone. If you go with me, then I'll go. You're not going with me, I won't go. There's an echo here. Do you know of anybody in Scripture who ever said that before? If you go with me, I'll go. No, Ruth is later. I'm talking about before. We got to go. The first five books are Joshua. Moses. Moses said to God, God says, you know, look, this people is stiff-necked, and you lead them. And Moses says, if you're not going with us, we're staying right here. We're not going to go unless you go with us. That's a pretty powerful statement. So you see, I think there's something here about this guy Barack or Barak, that his attitude seemed to be the task is more important than either tradition or sensitivity, and what we can accomplish together is way more than we're going to accomplish if I'm the only one involved. And the idea of working together and the things that can be accomplished that way, it seems to me that's emerging here.
Also, Deborah didn't take the credit. She gave it to Jarrell.
This is fun. If you read just that part, you just assume that's going to be Deborah. And it's not. It's not. You wonder what would have happened if... Well...
At what point do we realize, Bill, that if God asks us to do something, He's all nice to them, Lord?
There's something about the words that went between God and Moses that make me think we ought to at least make sure. God, give me a sense that you're in this too. But I take your point. I take your point.
I think, though, that we need to be humble enough to recognize that even though He may have sent us, if we go off on that mission and we don't go with Him, alongside Him, we're going to get into places we don't need to be if He doesn't go with us. So
if we're going in our own strength, that's true.
Right. So if I hear Him call me to do something and I say, okay, I'm going off to do it, and I leave Him sitting there, boy, am I going to get in trouble. I think it does behoove us to go, okay, I'll go, but come.
If our mindset is of that we're going to accomplish something.
Yeah, I think you get equally distracted with that.
But I mean, if we're in touch with God and we're patterning ourselves after Him, then I don't think we've got a problem.
But
and
the only thing I'm saying is I think conscious action to make that line of communication solid.
And timing, you know, because God called David 15 years, He anointed him as king 15 years before he actually became king over Judah. So if he had just taken off as a 15-year-old and decided he was going to be king at that time,
well, more,
the timing is huge.
Yeah, more importantly, when Saul was chasing him,
right,
before he became king,
right,
three or four times he was tempted and encouraged by the men with him.
Right.
Just take him out. The men probably knew he had been anointed.
Well, that has to do with God's agenda and timing.
Try to remember this when we get to Abigail. Try to remember this last little conversation when we get to Abigail. The idea of not going out ahead and the idea of perhaps God leading us to do things in this way and not in that way if we're consciously aware of that. Okay, this is a good conversation. Anything else?
I see the story is not putting limitations on God. You know, not trying to fit things in a box, so putting yourself in the socket. If I'm a woman and say this is my role, and this is, you know, it really is like what you were saying, moving beyond the boundaries of sexes, but moving towards we are all servers of God who has called us to do something.
Yeah, and there's almost, in another place in Judges is a section on Gideon. It may be the one right after the one we're in right now. I don't remember how quickly it comes. And I think I talked about Gideon when we talked about soldiers. He had an army of whatever it was, 30,000, 20,000, something like that. And God says, that's too many. If I give you the victory with that many soldiers, they're going to think they did it on their own. You got to cut the number down. Barry, you'll enjoy this one if you haven't seen it lately. He said, you got a few too many. And so the first thing he said was, if you're scared of going into battle, you can go home. And I don't remember what the number was. 11,000 went home. The guy said, still too many left. So he sent them down to the water at the riverbank, and he said to Gideon, watch how they drink. And the ones who put their face down in the water to drink, send them home. And the ones who bring the water up to their mouth, to my ears, and what little I know about soldiering, my suspicion is he's saying the ones who are actually continuing to be alert as they're drinking, because that's the difference that I see. Maybe it's not that. But he said, those are the ones you're going to take. When he got through, he had 300. Army, something like 30,000. He's now got 300. And God says, okay, now that's the right number. Because if you win with 300, it's clearly me and not you. He then sent the 300 into this huge encampment of the army that they were up against with no weapons. No weapons. They had horns and they had torches, and the torches were hidden underneath a pitcher of some kind. And in the middle of the night, all of them surrounded this camp, and they suddenly took the torches out and blew the horns. And the soldiers, in their confusion, got up, fought with each other, and they killed each other to the death. Nobody left. 300 people. God said, if there's too many of them, they will think it was them, and they won't realize it was me. So, in a way, that theme is actually running through Judges and running through other places, but it's sure here. It's big time here. Let's move to the second of ours, and these will be all we'll do this morning. We're going to move to Naomi and Ruth. What book is this? Ruth. And where is that? It's immediately after Judges. So if you found Judges, go to the very next one. It's probably worth reading the last verse of Judges before you read any of Ruth, because it sort of sets the stage in which Ruth, the book of Ruth happens. In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did as he saw fit. Now, the book of Ruth may be familiar to some of you, may not be, but my notes at this point say Deborah, Judges 4 and 5, Ruth. And I don't think we have time to read the whole book, so let's do some summarizing. There was a woman by the name of Naomi, and she and her husband had two sons. Famine had come to the land of Israel where they were living, and they decided they needed to go someplace else if they were going to avoid starving to death. And they go to a foreign country. What's the country? Some of you know. Moab. Okay, a neighboring country. They go into that country, and while they're there, the two boys marry girls that they met in Moab. Now, boys from Israel in those days weren't supposed to do that. The rules in the Old Testament said you're supposed to marry within the nation of Israel. In fact, I think Travis talked about that in one of his sermons the last week or the week before, that there's a verse in the New Testament, don't be unequally yoked, and he talked about that sort of thing. But anyway, that's what they did. They married these two girls from Moab. As time goes by, daddy dies, son number one dies, son number two dies. What you got now?
Mother-in-law and two daughters.
Three widows. Mother-in-law, two daughters-in-law. The mother-in-law is from Israel. The two daughters are from Moab. Okay? Things are getting a little better back in Israel. Word comes for this. Naomi says, I'm going to go home. I've got family there. You know, maybe something can work out. If you are the daughters-in-law, what should you do? You can go to your family. The two daughters-in-law, who are the two daughters-in-law? One is easy, Ruth. One is harder, Orpah. Say, we want to go with you. Naomi does what she's supposed to do. It tells them not to. Orpah listens and goes back. Ruth says something powerful and stays with her. What she says, this is a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law, is read in wedding ceremonies all over this country because it's beautiful. Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. It's beautiful. And off they go. They come back, and now we come to verse 1 of chapter 2. The last verse of chapter 1, verse 22, this was how Naomi came home with her daughter-in-law, Ruth the Moabitess, on returning from the plains of Moab. They arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now, verse 1 of chapter 2 gives you some foreknowledge that I just assume you not have. So don't read verse 1 yet. Let's start at verse 2. Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, let me go into the fields and glean ears of corn in the footsteps of some man who will look on me with favor. Naomi replied, go, daughter. So she set out and went to glean in the fields behind the reapers or the harvesters. Chance led her to a plot of land belonging to Boaz of Elimelech's clan. Boaz, as it happened, had just come from Bethlehem. Now, my picture is, if you look back at verse 22, They had just arrived in Bethlehem. Boaz had just come from Bethlehem. I have a picture that this is a farm outside of town, and Boaz was coming out from town to this farm. The harvesters were already at work. Okay? Now, let's get some pieces in place. She said, I'm going to go and glean behind the harvesters. Okay? There were rules associated with gleaning in those days. First of all, what is gleaning? G-L-E-A-N-I-N-G. Picking up what didn't get harvested. Okay? Or what's in the corners or something like that. If you've got mechanized systems now and you've got a field, you swing around the corner, there might be a little section you miss or something like that. There were two rules that covered gleaning. There may be six more, but there are two big ones. What are those two big ones? Some of you know. Okay? First of all, it was not trespassing to come into a field for this purpose. Sort of 1B is you had to be poor. You couldn't come in there if you had means. This was something for poor people. Poor people could come into a field for this purpose and they would not be trespassing and could not be arrested and prosecuted for such. Okay? But there was a second rule, and it's almost as important. You know what that rule is?
Farmer itself couldn't clean up.
You cannot harvest thoroughly. You get one pass, and if it hits the ground, you can't pick it up and throw it on the wagon. If you're shaking the apple tree, the apples you catch are yours. The ones you miss, they're on the ground for the poor folks. They weren't gleaning apples. What were they gleaning? Verse 22, mine says barley. She talks about ears of corn. I don't think they had corn as we know corn, so I think they're probably talking about the same thing. Okay? Now, let's read on for a moment. Chance led her to a plot of land belonging to Boaz. Verse 4, Boaz, as it happened, had just come from Bethlehem. There's two as it happened just in a row. As it happened, she went to this field. As it happened, he had just come out from Bethlehem. The Lord be with you, he said to whom? The harvesters or the reapers. The Lord bless you, they replied. Boaz said to a servant of his who was in charge of the harvesters, to whom does this young woman belong? Why do you think he said that? I can think of at least three reasons that you should be able to give me now. One is, he knew the poor people of Bethlehem. He had been watching them every time he harvested, and there's somebody new in the field. Number two, there's a guy named Lawrence Block who is writing novels for the last 40 years, I guess. And I didn't really become aware of him until very recently. I think it's in one of his novels that this line comes, although it could have come in a Robert De Niro movie. There's a woman who says to a male character, you're staring at me. And the male says back, you're hard not to look at. One suspects that that's there too. She's somebody that you would notice for whatever reason. Okay? So, she's not one of the usual suspects, and she stands out. Now, there might be other reasons you can think of, but I can think of at least those two. So, to whom does this young woman belong? The servant in charge of the harvesters replied, the girl is the Moabitess. Chances are the whole little town knows that Naomi has come back. The one who came back with Naomi from the plains of Moab. She said, that means the foreman is now quoting Ruth. She said, please let me glean and pick up what falls from the sheaves behind the harvesters. End of quote. Thus she came, and here she stayed, with hardly a rest from morning until now. What does Boaz now know about this person, besides the fact that she's Naomi's daughter-in-law and a foreigner?
She was kind enough to ask for permission on something she didn't need permission on.
That's a big one. I forgot to say that in the first hour. This is a person with respect for other people's property. She asked when almost certainly she would have known that she had a right to go and didn't have to ask permission. Okay.
But if that was Jewish law, why would she know that? Because she came from a land that was idol worshiping.
Well, verse 2, she's talking to Naomi. Almost certainly Naomi will inform her of this. You know, you have a right to be there. Don't let them turn you away. I suspect she would have said that. But she is still a person who is asking for permission for something she does. That to me shows respect. Okay, I don't know what would happen if she'd gotten a different answer. What else does he know about her? She is a hard worker with hardly a rest from morning till now. Sounds like she got up early. Early bird gets the worm. I saw something posted in the hallway of my building 20 years ago, and I've remembered it ever since. It was a poster, and it said, "Everything comes to the one who waits." Everything that is left over from the one who hustled. That's a pretty powerful little statement. That's a pretty powerful little statement. With hardly a rest from morning until now. Verse 8, Boaz speaks to Ruth. "Listen to me, daughter. You must not go gleaning in any other field. You must not go away from here. Stay close to my work women. Keep your eyes on whatever part of the field they are harvesting and follow behind." And then comes the most chilling words that I've seen in this part of the Bible. "I have forbidden my men to molest you."
What?
Does yours say that?
Mm-hmm.
Not to touch you. Mine says not to molest you. I think mine says it more accurately. Why would Boaz need to say that?
I forbidden them to touch you.
It implies that they did
it. It implies that it might have been customary or normal to have such things go on.
And he's telling her to walk behind the girls, the servant girls, I guess, not to be a temptation.
The picture I have is that the men are hauling the wagon or moving the carts or doing the lifting, and the women are the ones bending over. And with, I don't know if that's right or not. "Stay close to the work women, and I have forbidden my men to molest you." Those are hard words, folks.
Yeah.
When you're poor and you're desperate, there are people who will take advantage of you. Yeah. This was 2,500 years ago, maybe 3,000 years ago. Does this happen anymore?
Yeah.
All the flipping time. And it's just as ugly now as it was then. It's just as ugly now as it was then. But it goes further than that. "And if you are thirsty, go to the pitchers and drink what the servants have drawn." What did Boaz just do for her? He has given her shelter. He has given her safety. And he has given her rights that go beyond the right. A gleaner comes into the field, you better bring your own water, or if you're thirsty, just... your problem.
He covered her when she didn't really have a covering.
Mm-hmm. You just saw the theme of this book.
What you're going to learn is when she gets home and tells Naomi about this, Naomi almost screams for joy. And that's why I don't like verse 1 being where it is, because it gives it away too soon. I want you to have the same sense of surprise. "He is one of the ones who has the right of redemption over us," Naomi says. Where is that? Verse 20. "This man is a close relation of ours. He is one of those who has the right of redemption over us." Does that mean he was Naomi's kinsman? Nope. He was a kinsman of Naomi's husband. Read it.
May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to heaven. This is.
We can say Boaz was giving her covering, and I think there is beauty and power in that thought. He recognizes she's under God's protection, and his protection is simply an extension of that.
And it wasn't her God that was trying to introduce her.
You have come to the God of Israel.
Well, undoubtedly for her relationship with Ruth before the death of her husband.
May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord your God. Shall we jump to the end? By the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. Can we jump to the end? What happens? Where's this going? What happens to Boaz and Ruth? They end up married. Not only that, they have a child. And in chapter 4, I think it is, and I think it's verse 16 or 17. Let me double check and make sure. 16. Grandma raises the kid. Or at least helps raise the kid. She becomes, if you will, a caretaker for the baby. And who's the baby? David's granddaddy. She's just become the great-grandmother Naomi has of a king. This is a beautiful story. But hiding in this is the idea of a kinsman redeemer. He is one of those who has the right of redemption over us. He is one of those who has a right of redemption over us. He is not the one. He is one of those. Okay? Now what does that have to do with? Jewish law, you go back to the first five books of the Bible, Jewish law, it's a little funny to our ears. If you have a brother and he has children, his children will inherit what was your brother's. But if your brother dies childless, then you take his wife to be your wife. You bring children from that wife. And those children are not your children. They're your brother's children, and they inherit what your brother had. That gets lost a little bit in here. The way Ruth is written, that's not perfectly followed. But that's what stands behind this. Right of redemption means that you marry, and what that does is you then produce heirs that take over that. So you don't inherit, you don't sort of take your brother's property. You make sure there's somebody else who takes it and you don't get it. So that's a little bit selfless. And what happens is that Boaz realizes he's not number one in line, he's number two in line. And so he gets number one out by the city gates and he calls 10 men and has them sit at a certain section. You almost see a jury being formed. And he says to the guy, by the way, Naomi's back. And that means all that property that Naomi's husband owned and that his sons would have inherited, all that property is now going to go to whoever redeems that family. And the guy says, that's a good idea. I think I'll do that. And then Boaz begins to remind him of his responsibilities. This is where, again, it's not perfectly aligned with the way that I read the law as described in Leviticus, but it's pretty close. And he realizes the obligations are a lot more than the benefits. And he says, why don't you do that? And Boaz says, well, let's just make sure that we do this right. So let's enter a contract here. And that's why the 10 men were there. And there's a shoe thrown on the ground into a circle. And it's all kind of funny and old. But the end of this is Boaz becomes the kinsman redeemer, covering her when there was no one else to cover her. That's a picture of what Jesus does later. The parallel is not perfect, but the parallel is there. And the reason this book is here is as much as anything for that. The love that Ruth showed Naomi, the love Naomi showed Ruth, and the kinsman redeemer and the work of the kinsman redeemer.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Talking about another woman in the Bible, Matthew 1:5, Stan and the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab.
I wasn't going to bring that up, but it turns out there's prostitutes and foreigners and adulteresses and all these back there in the line. And it's interesting the way God can call and use people that the world might think couldn't possibly be used. Yeah.
What lessons do you see? Can I show you just a little bit more of Boaz's kindness? Maybe you've skimmed through this already. Verse 13, she says to Boaz, Ruth says to Boaz, "My Lord, I hope you will always look on me with favor. You have comforted and encouraged me, though I am not even the equal of one of your workwomen." Verse 14, when it was time to eat. I'm still in chapter 2. I just went back to the middle of that story we read. Wings and refuge and all that, and the verses right after that. When it was time to eat, Boaz said to her, "Come and eat some of this bread and dip your piece of the vinegar." Ruth sat down beside the harvesters, and Boaz made a heap of roasted grain for her. She ate until her hunger was satisfied. This probably was the first good meal she had had in a long time. And she had some left over. When she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his workpeople, "Let her glean among the sheaves themselves." There was apparently a place that, you know, maybe she wasn't supposed to go into a certain area. I could picture there might have been an area that hasn't been harvested yet, but some of the stuff has already fallen. Maybe she could get in there. "Do not molest her, and be sure you pull a few ears of corn out of the bundles and drop them. Make sure you're not as careful harvesting today as you might ordinarily be. Let her glean them and do not scold her." So she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it came to about a bushel of barley. Taking it home with her, she went back to town. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. Ruth also took out what she had kept after eating all she wanted and gave that to Naomi. And her mother-in-law said, "Where have you been gleaning today?" She was expecting Ruth to come back with some grain, but probably not a bushel. But the grain she came back with included not only uncooked, it also included cooked. How did she get cooked grain? "Where have you been gleaning today? Where have you been working? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." And she told her, "Boaz." And Naomi says, "He's the one among those who have the right of redemption over us." There's a couple of other things happening here. Of the poorest of the poor in those days, who would they have been? The widows and the orphans and the foreigners. And here was 2 out of 3. God looks after the poor. But he also looked after Boaz. Boaz wasn't married. We don't know why.
God is watching over us. Rich and poor, old and young,
citizen and foreigner, keep going with whatever distinctions you want. After the first hour this morning, somebody came up and said, "The reason I work in the ESL program through this church is because there are people who are foreigners and they're wanting to become Americans. And I want to be part of that. I want to help them." That's biblical. That's very biblical. How you doing? I think we're through for the morning, unless you have another comment. Anybody? Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, this morning we've seen two very different situations. A person who was the leader of her community, listening to you and agreeing to work with others so that somebody else would get the credit, but so that your will would be done and so that people would be protected. And then we see somebody who's almost the lowest of the low finding favor and being lifted up by a kinsman redeemer. And we understand that that's what our brother Jesus has done for us, is to serve as our kinsman redeemer, covering us when no one else was there who could cover us, giving us protection under his wings. We thank you for your guidance. We thank you for your Spirit to be working among us. We pray that you would give us ears to hear when the Spirit speaks. Take us through the week that is to come. Show us the things that you have for us to do in your kingdom. And if it's your will, bring us back together next week, for we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Yeah.